Coxon by Robin Cook. Continued. Cassette 2, Side 2. Routine emergencies, Kim questioned. It was a ridiculous oxymoron. All at once, the idea of trying to talk to this clerk reminded him of the frustration of having to deal with medically untrained people when he called insurance companies or managed care plans to get clearance for patients. That chore had become one of the truly exasperating problems of modern office practice. "Please wait at the end of the line," the receptionist said. "If you'll allow me to concentrate and get these people before you signed in, I'll be able to take your information sooner." She then directed her full attention to the drunk. In the interim, he'd managed to gather the contents of his wallet. Kim started to protest, but it was all too obvious it was a waste of time to try to talk with this woman. It occurred to him that she might not even know what the term "on staff" meant. With growing frustration, humiliation, and irritation, Kim returned to Tracy. "I don't know where they find these people," Kim complained. "They're like automatons." "I'm impressed by how your exalted position in this hospital has greased the skids for us." "Your sarcasm doesn't help one iota," Kim snapped. "It's all because of the merger. I'm not known down here. In fact, I can't remember ever coming to this ER. If you'd taken Becky's complaints seriously over the weekend, we probably wouldn't have to be here now," Tracy said. "I took them seriously," Kim said defensively. "Oh, sure," Tracy said. "By giving her some over-the-counter diarrhea medications? That's really an aggressive approach. But you know something? I'm not surprised you didn't do more. You've never taken seriously any symptoms Becky has ever had, or mine either, for that matter." "That's not true," Kim said hotly. "Oh, yes, it is," Tracy said. "Only someone married to a surgeon would know what I'm talking about. From your perspective, any symptom less than what would call for immediate open-heart surgery is a kind of malingering." "I resent that," Kim said. "Yeah, well, so do I," Tracy said. "All right, Miss Know-It-All," Kim snapped. "What would you have had me do with Becky over the weekend?" "Have her seen by somebody," Tracy said. "One of your many colleagues. You must have 1,000 doctor friends. It wouldn't have been too much to ask." "Wait a second," Kim said, struggling to control himself. "All Becky had was just simple diarrhea and some cramps, both of short duration. And it was the weekend. I wasn't going to bother someone with such symptoms." "Mommy," Becky called. She'd come up behind Kim and Tracy. "I have to go to the bathroom." Tracy turned and, reminded of her daughter's discomfort, her anger immediately mellowed. She put her arm over Becky's shoulder. "I'm sorry, dear. Sure, we'll find you a bathroom." "Wait," Kim said. "This could be helpful. We'll need a sample. I'll get a stool sample container." "You must be joking," Tracy said. "I'm sure she has to go now." "Hold on, Becky," Kim said. "I'll be right back." Kim walked deliberately and quickly into the depths of the ER. Without Becky and Tracy, he wasn't challenged as he passed the nurse's desk. For the moment, the mammoth Molly McFadden was nowhere to be seen. The interior of the ER was a series of large rooms divided into separate cubicles by curtains that hung from overhead tracks. In addition, there were individual trauma rooms, replete with state-of-the-art equipment. There were also a handful of examination rooms used primarily for psychiatric cases. Like the outer waiting area, the ER proper was packed and chaotic. Every trauma room was occupied, and staff physicians, residents, nurses, and orderlies swirled between them in continuous motion. As he walked, Kim searched for someone he recognized. Unfortunately, he didn't see anyone he knew. He stopped an orderly. "Excuse me," Kim said. "I need a stool sample container ASAP. The orderly gave Kim a rapid once-over with his eyes. "Who are you?"
"Dr. Regis," Kim said. "You got an ID?"
Kim produced his hospital identification card.
"Okay," the orderly said. "I'll be right back."
Kim watched the man disappear through an unmarked door that apparently led to a storeroom.
"Coming through," a voice called.
Kim turned around in time to see a portable X-ray unit bearing down on him. He stepped to the side as the heavy machine was trundled past by an X-ray technician. A moment later, the orderly reappeared. He handed Kim 2 clear plastic bags with plastic containers inside.
"Thanks," Kim said.
"Don't mention it," the orderly said. Kim hurried back the way he'd come. Tracy and Becky were still in line, although they had moved up a few feet. Becky had her eyes shut tight.
Tears streaked her face. Kim handed one of the plastic bags to Tracy. "Cramps?" he questioned. "Of course, you lunkhead," Tracy said. Tracy grabbed Becky's hand and led her back to the restroom. Kim held their place in line as it advanced by one more patient. Now there were two check-in clerks. Apparently the other had been off on break. By 9:15, the ER waiting room was filled to overflowing. All the molded plastic chairs were occupied. The rest of the people were leaning up against the walls or sprawled on the floor. There was little conversation. In one corner, a television hung suspended from the ceiling. It was tuned to CNN. A number of unhappy infants drowned out the newscaster. Outside, it had started to rain. The smell of wet wool filled the air. Kim, Tracy, and Becky had eventually found seats together and had not moved, except for Becky, who'd made several more trips to the restroom. Kim was holding the stool sample container. Although there had been some spots of bright red blood originally, now the contents appeared a uniform light brown. Becky was miserable and mortified. Tracy was exasperated. Kim was still seething. "I don't believe this," Kim said suddenly. "I truly don't believe this. Every second I think we'll be called, but it doesn't happen." He glanced at his watch. "We've been here an hour and a half."
"Welcome to the real world," Tracy said.
"This is what Kelly Anderson should have done her merger story about," Kim said. "This is ridiculous. Americare closed the ER at the Samaritan to cut costs and make everyone come here. It's all just to maximize profits."
"And maximize inconvenience," Tracy added.
"It's true," Kim agreed. "Americare definitely wants to discourage emergency room usage."
"I can't think of a better way," Tracy said.
"I can't believe that not one of the staff people has recognized me," Kim growled. "It's incredible. Hell, I'm probably the best-known cardiac surgeon in the department."
"Isn't there something you can do?" Tracy pleaded. "Becky's miserable."
Kim stood up. "All right," he said. "I'll try."
"But don't lose your temper," Tracy admonished. "It might make everything worse."
"How can it be worse?" Kim replied. Kim walked out of the waiting room on his way to the nurse's desk. He'd gone only a few steps when the wailing of an ambulance siren reverberated through the main swinging doors to his left. A moment later, a flashing red light was seen through the door's glass panels. The siren died off, and soon the doors burst open. Several bloodied people, apparently auto accident victims, were rolled in and whisked into the ER proper. Kim could not help but wonder if these new arrivals meant Becky would have to wait that much longer. Kim approached the nurse's desk. Again he looked for Molly McFadden, but she was still out of sight. The people there were a clerk, who was on the phone transcribing laboratory values, and a solitary nurse doing paperwork while sipping coffee. Her name tag read, "Monica Hoskins, ER Staff Nurse." Forcing himself to be civil, Kim got her attention by gently tapping the countertop.
"Good evening," he said when she looked up at him.
"Perhaps you recognize me?"
Monica narrowed her eyes slightly as she gazed at Kim.
"No, I don't think I do," she said. "Should I?"
"I'm on the surgical attending staff," Kim said. "But right now I'm here with my daughter, and we've been waiting for over an hour and a half. Could you tell me when she'll be seen?"
"It's been a busy night, especially with auto accidents," Monica explained. "What's the name?"
"Dr. Regis," Kim said. He squared his shoulders.
"No, the patient's name," Monica said.
"Rebecca Regis," Kim said. Monica picked up a stack of ER sign-in sheets. After wetting the tip of her index finger with her tongue, she rapidly flipped through the papers.
"Okay," she remarked as she withdrew one of them. "Here it is."
She read the chief complaint and then raised her face to Kim. She arched her eyebrows.
"Diarrhea, 2 days duration," she commented. "Not exactly a 4+ emergency."
Kim lifted the stool sample container to bring it into her line of sight. "She's been passing a little bit of blood this afternoon," Kim said. Monica leaned forward.
"Doesn't look like blood."
"It did earlier," Kim said, "and it has her mother upset."
"Well, we'll get to her as soon as we can," Monica said, noncommittedly. "That's about all I can say."
She replaced Becky's sign-in sheet to its former location in the stack. "Listen," Kim said in a deliberately controlled voice. "As a member of the staff, I expect some consideration, and after waiting this long already, I want her to be seen shortly. I hope I'm making myself clear. She's in considerable discomfort." Monica treated Kim to a patently false smile.
As I said a moment ago, we'll get to her as soon as we can. We have limited resources. If you've been here for an hour and a half, I'm sure you've seen the auto accidents that have come in. And now the police have alerted us a shooting victim is on his way.
No sooner had these last words escaped from Monica's lips than the familiar sound of an arriving ambulance could be heard.
In fact, I'd wager that's them now, Monica said as she got to her feet.
She moved over to an intercom and pressed a button. Talking to someone in one of the trauma rooms, she informed them to get ready. Then she herself disappeared back into the depths of the ER. With little satisfaction for his latest efforts, Kim headed back to the waiting room. As he passed by the main entrance doors, a team of EMTs rushed in with the shooting victim on a gurney. The patient had an oxygen mask strapped over his face and an IV running. His color was ashen.
Well? Tracy asked as Kim reclaimed his seat.
They said they'd see her as soon as they could, Kim said. He was embarrassed to relate the rest of the conversation. He noticed that Becky had curled up in her seat as best she could and had her eyes closed.
That's pretty vague, Tracy said.
What does it mean? 15 minutes? An hour? Tomorrow morning? It means exactly as soon as they can, Kim snapped. A shooting victim just came in, and victims from an auto accident came in a few minutes ago. It's a busy night.
Tracy sighed and shook her head in frustration.
How's Becky doing? Kim asked.
She just had another bout of cramps, Tracy said. So you guess. You're the doctor.
Kim looked away, gritting his teeth. It was hard not to lose his temper, and on top of everything else, he was hungry. For the next hour, Kim was sullenly silent. He was busy brooding over this ridiculous ER experience and eager to complain to his colleagues about it. They would understand. Tracy and Becky seemed more resigned to the wait. Every time one of the nurses or residents came to the waiting room threshold to call out a name, Kim expected it to be Rebecca Regis, but it never was. Finally, Kim looked at his watch.
It's been 2.5 freaking hours.
He stood up.
I truly can't believe this. If I were the slightest bit paranoid, I'd think it was some kind of screwy conspiracy. This time I'm going to make something happen. I'll be right back.
Tracy glanced up at her former husband. Under more normal circumstances, she'd be concerned about Kim's temper. But after having been kept waiting so long, she didn't care. She wanted Becky seen. She didn't comment as Kim stalked off. Kim marched directly back to the nurse's desk. A number of the ER staff was scattered about the station, engaged in desultory conversation punctuated by laughter. Upon reaching the counter, Kim scanned the group for a recognizable face. No one looked familiar, and none seemed to recognize him. In fact, the only person to notice his presence was the clerk, a young, college-aged boy who was most likely a student at the university.
"I'm Dr. Regis," Kim said. "What's happening?"
He motioned to all the people.
"They're just taking a breather," the clerk said. "The shooting victim and the last car accident patients just went up to surgery."
"Well, who's the acting head of the emergency department for the evening shift?" Kim asked.
"That would be Dr. David Washington," the clerk said.
"Is he here at the moment?" Kim asked. The clerk glanced around the area to be sure.
"No," he said. "I believe he's back with an orthopedic case."
"How about a head nurse or a nurse supervisor?" Kim asked.
"That would be Nora Labatt," the clerk said. "She's with a psych patient."
"I see," Kim said. "Thanks." Kim proceeded down the counter until he was at the very center. Raising his hand, he called out,
"Excuse me, everybody. Hello."
No one acknowledged Kim's voice or gesture. For another moment, he glanced around, trying to make eye contact with anyone. It was impossible. Instead, he reached across the counter and lifted a metallic in-and-out basket from the desktop. Holding it above his head for a moment, he thought someone might notice. They didn't. Kim brought the metal basket down to crash onto the Formica counter. He smashed it down twice again, each time with more force, until the basket became distorted to the shape of a three-dimensional parallelogram. That got everyone's attention. Conversations stopped in mid-sentence. Residents, nurses, and orderlies all stared at Kim. A security man who'd been standing over near the bank of elevators came running over, his hand holding the clutch of keys attached to his belt. Having worked himself up to a fury, Kim's voice was tremulous.
"I know you all are busy, but you certainly don't look busy at the moment. I've been waiting here for 2.5 hours with my daughter. As a professional man myself, my time could be spent in much more valuable ways."
"Excuse me, sir,"
the security man said. He took hold of Kim's arm. Kim yanked his arm free and spun around on the man.
"Don't you touch me!" Kim snarled.
The security man wisely stepped back while he grappled for his two-way radio. Kim was not only a half a foot taller, but also significantly more muscled.
"No need to contact anyone," Kim said.
He pulled out his hospital ID and held it up to the security man's face.
"I'm on the staff here, even though no one here in the emergency department seems willing to concede it."
The security man's eyes narrowed as he read Kim's ID card.
"Sorry, doctor," he said.
"That's quite all right," Kim said with a controlled voice. He turned back to the desk. Monica Hoskins had stepped forward.
"I'd like to talk with Dr. David Washington," Kim said.
"I'm sorry you've had to wait," Monica said. "We're doing the best we can."
"Nonetheless, I'd like to speak to the acting head of the department," Kim said.
"Dr. Washington is tied up with a pneumothorax," Molly explained.
"I want to see him now," Kim said evenly. "I'm sure there must be at least one resident competent to handle a pneumothorax."
"Just a moment," Monica said.
She stepped back and, out of earshot from Kim, conferred with Molly and several of the other staff. In less than a minute, she returned to Kim. In the background, one of the nurses she'd been talking with picked up a phone.
"We'll have someone here in authority to talk with you momentarily," Monica said.
"It's about time," Kim remarked. Kim's mini-tantrum had unnerved the staff, and most of them vacated the nurse's desk for the interior of the ER. Monica took the in-and-out basket Kim had bent and tried to bend it back. She was unsuccessful. Kim's pulse was racing. A sudden commotion behind him made him turn around. A teenage girl was being escorted by a vanguard of EMTs. She was sobbing. Both wrists were bound with bloody dish towels. A clear suicide attempt. No doubt in this young woman's case, a desperate cry for help. Kim looked expectantly into the ER depths after the teenager was taken in. He expected to see the doctor in charge appear at any moment. Instead, he felt a tap on his shoulder. Turning around, he was surprised to see Tracy.
"Where's Becky?" Kim asked.
"In the restroom," Tracy answered. "It's a routine visit this time, but I have to get right back. I just came in here to beg you not to have one of your narcissistic rages. When you stood up in the waiting room to come in here, I didn't think I cared whether you got into a furor or not, but I do. I'm convinced it won't improve an already bad situation. In fact, it might cause Becky to have to wait even longer."
"Spare me your psychobabble," Kim spat. "All I'm planning on is a sane but pointed conversation with the man who runs this place. I mean, this is unacceptable, plain and simple."
"Just try to control yourself," Tracy said icily. "When you're done, you'll know where to find us." Tracy turned around and walked back toward the waiting room. Kim drummed his fingers impatiently on the counter. After a while, he looked at his watch. Another 5 minutes had passed. Once again, he leaned out into the corridor to peer back into the ER depths. He saw plenty of staff, but no one came striding in his direction. Kim's eyes met the clerk's, who immediately averted his gaze. The rest of the ER staff avoided looking at Kim, instead busying themselves with paperwork. A muffled bell sounded to herald the arrival of an elevator. Kim looked over to see a hefty man dressed in a conservative gray business suit disembark. To Kim's surprise, he came directly up to him.
"Dr. Regis?" the man inquired.
His voice was robust and commanding.
"I'm Dr. Regis," Kim agreed.
"I'm Barclay Bradford," the man said stiffly. "I'm a vice president of the hospital and the acting chief administrator for the evening shift."
"How convenient," Kim said.
"What I'd advise you to do is go back into the ER, locate the asshole acting head of the department, and drag him out here. He and I have something to talk about. You see, I've been waiting for 2.5 hours to have my daughter seen."
"Dr. Regis," Barclay began, as if Kim had not even spoken. "As a member of our professional staff, particularly a surgeon, you of all people know that triage is necessary in a busy ER. Life-threatening problems have to take precedence over simple juvenile diarrhea."
"Of course I understand triage," Kim shot back. "I've worked in ERs all through my training. But let me tell you something. When I walked in here 10 minutes ago, there had to be a dozen ER staff hanging out behind this counter drinking coffee and chit-chatting."
"Appearances never tell the whole story," Barclay commented condescendingly.
He fluttered his eyelids. They were probably conferring with each other over particularly difficult cases. But regardless, your childish behavior of pounding a letterbox on a countertop cannot be tolerated. It's entirely inappropriate for you to demand special treatment.
Special treatment? Kim sputtered. Childish behavior? His face reddened and his eyes bulged.
The administrator in front of him suddenly embodied his frustrations about the present emergency room experience, the hospital merger, Americare, and modern medicine in general. With a sudden fit of fury and losing all semblance of control, Kim struck the administrator with a lightning blow to the chin. Kim shook his hand and clasped it with his other in response to the sudden pain in his knuckle. At the same time, Barkley rocked back on his heels, teetered, then fell heavily to the floor. Kim was stunned by his violent reaction. Taking a step forward, he looked down at Barkley and felt an impulse to help the man up. A collective gasp arose from the staff behind the desk. The security guard came running. The clerk grabbed the intercom to announce,
"Mayday at the nurse's desk!"
From the depths of the ER, residents, nurses, and orderlies came streaming out. Even Tracy appeared after hearing the announcement. A crowd gathered around Kim and Barkley. The hospital VP had pushed himself up to a sitting position. He touched a hand to his lip. It was bleeding.
"Damn it, Kim," Tracy said. "I warned you."
"This is totally unacceptable," Monica said. She turned to the clerk. "Call the police."
"Hold up. Don't call anybody," a deep, resonant voice called.
The crowd parted. A powerfully built, handsome African-American man appeared. He snapped latex gloves from his hands as he walked into the center of the ring. The name tag pinned to his scrub top read, "Dr. David Washington, Acting Chief Emergency Department." His eyes went from Kim down to Barkley.
"What's going on here?"
"Mr. Bradford was just struck by this man," Monica said, pointing at Kim, "and that was after he destroyed a letterbox by bashing it against the counter."
"Believe it or not, he's a doctor on the hospital staff," Molly added.
David put out a hand and got Barkley to his feet. David glanced at the man's split lip and palpated along the line of his jaw.
"Are you all right?" David asked the administrator.
"I think so."
He got out a handkerchief and dabbed at his bloodied lip. David turned to Monica.
"Take Mr. Bradford back and get him cleaned up, and have Dr. Kruger take a look at him to see if we should get an X-ray."
"Sure," Monica said.
She grasped Barkley's arm above the elbow to guide him through the crowd. Barkley glared at Kim before allowing himself to be led away.
"Everyone else, back to work," David said with a wave of his hand.
Then he turned to Kim, who'd recovered his senses.
"What is your name?" David asked.
"I'm Dr. Kim Regis."
"Did you really hit Mr. Bradford?" David asked incredulously.
"I'm afraid so," Kim said.
"What on earth could have provoked you?" David asked.
Kim took a deep breath.
"That prig condescendingly accused me of demanding special treatment when my sick child has been waiting for 2.5 hours.
David stared at Kim for a beat. He was mystified at such behavior from a colleague.
"What's the child's name?" he asked.
"Rebecca Regis," Kim said. David turned to the clerk and asked for Rebecca's sign-in sheet. The clerk fumbled through the stack.
"Are you really on staff here at the University Med Center?" David asked while he waited for the sheet.
"Since the merger," Kim said, "I'm one of the cardiac surgeons, although you'd never know it the way I've been treated here in the ER."
"We do the best we can," David said.
"Yeah, I've heard that excuse several times tonight," Kim said. David eyed Kim again.
"You know, you should be ashamed of yourself," he said. "Punching people out, smashing letterboxes, you're acting like some malcontent teenager."
"Screw you," Kim said.
"For the moment, I'm going to chalk that remark up to stress," David said.
"Don't be patronizing," Kim said.
"Here it is," the clerk said. He handed the sign-in sheet to David.
David glanced at it, then looked at his watch.
"At least you're right about the time. It's been close to 3 hours. That's certainly no justification for your behavior, but it's too long to wait."
David looked at Tracy.
"Are you Mrs. Regis?" he asked.
"I'm Rebecca Regis's mother," Tracy said.
"Why don't you get the young lady? I'll personally see to it she's seen immediately."
"Thank you," Tracy said.
She hurried out to the waiting room. David went behind the desk to get a clipboard for the sign-in sheet. He also used the intercom to get a nurse to come out. When he reemerged, Tracy was back with Becky in tow. A moment later, a nurse appeared. Her name tag identified her as Nicole Michaels.
How are you feeling, young lady? David asked Becky.
Not too good, Becky admitted. I want to go home.
I'm sure you do, David said. But first, let's check you out. Why don't you go ahead with Nicole? She'll get you situated in one of the examination cubicles.
Tracy, Becky, and Kim started forward. David reached out to restrain Kim.
I'd prefer that you wait out here, if you don't mind, David said.
I'm going with my daughter, Kim stated.
No, you are not, David said. You've proved yourself emotionally stressed. You're acting like a loose cannon.
Kim hesitated. As much as he didn't want to admit it, David had a point. Still, it was irritating and demeaning.
Come on, doctor, David said. Surely you understand.
Kim cast a glance at the receding image of Becky and Tracy. He looked back at David, who was not about to be intimidated, physically or otherwise.
But, Kim began. No buts, David said. Don't make me call the police, which I'll do if you don't cooperate.
Reluctantly, Kim turned around and walked back to the waiting room. There were no seats, so he leaned up against the wall by the entrance. He tried to watch the television, but couldn't concentrate. He raised his hand and looked at it. He was trembling. A half hour later, Tracy and Becky emerged from the treatment area. It was by chance that Kim happened to see them as they pushed through the exit door. They were leaving without even having tried to find him. Kim quickly gathered his coat and gloves and hurried after them. He caught up to them just as Tracy was helping Becky climb into the car. "What are you going to do?" Kim demanded. "Just ignore me?" Tracy didn't say anything. She shut the door behind Becky and then walked around to the driver's side door. Kim followed and put his hand on the door to keep it from opening.
"Please don't cause any more trouble," Tracy said. "You've already embarrassed both of us."
Taken aback by this new and unexpected affront, Kim took his hand away. Tracy got into the car. She reached for the door, but then didn't close it. She looked up into Kim's surprised and hurt face.
"Go home and get some sleep," she said. "That's what we're going to do."
"What happened in there?" Kim asked. "What did they say?"
"Not much," Tracy reported.
"Apparently her blood count and electrolytes, whatever they are fine. I'm supposed to give her broth and other fluids and lay off the dairy products."
"Is that all?" Kim asked.
"That's it," Tracy said.
"But, by the way, they said the culprit could very well have been Ginger's chicken. They see a lot of food poisoning secondary to chicken."
"It wasn't," Kim shot back. "No way. Ask Becky. She was feeling sick the morning before the chicken." Kim leaned over to talk directly to his daughter. "Isn't that right, Pumpkin?"
"I want to go home," Becky said, staring out through the windshield.
"Good night, Kim," Tracy said.
She pulled the door shut, started the car, and drove away. Kim watched the car until it had disappeared behind the corner of the hospital. Only then did he start walking toward the doctor's parking area. He felt alone, more alone than he'd ever felt in his life.
Chapter 7. Tuesday, January 20th.
The OR door burst open, and Kim and Tom entered the scrub area outside OR number 20. As they did so, they untied their face masks and let them drop down over their chests. They rinsed off the talc from their hands.
"Hey, thanks for lending a hand on such short notice," Tom said.
"Glad to help," Kim said flatly.
The two men started walking up the corridor toward the recovery room.
"You seem down in the dumps," Tom said. "What happened? Did your accountant just call you about your bottom line in response to the new Medicare reimbursement rates?"
Kim didn't laugh. He didn't respond at all.
"Are you all right?" Tom asked,
seriously this time.
"I suppose," Kim said without emotion. "Just a lot of aggravation."
Kim then told Tom what had happened in the ER the night before.
"Whoa," Tom commented when Kim was finished. "What a god-awful experience. But don't be down on yourself for taking a poke at that Barkley Bradford character. I had a mini run-in with him myself. Administrators. You know, I read in a journal last night that in the United States there's currently one administrator for every 1.5 doctors or nurses. Can you believe that?"
"Yeah, I can," Kim said. "That's a big part of why our healthcare costs are so high."
"That was exactly the point of the article," Tom said. "But anyway, I can understand why you popped Bradford. If it had been me, I know I would have been bullshit. 3 hours? Hell, I'd have punched him out as a minimum."
"Thanks, Tom," Kim said. "I appreciate your support. But the worst part of the whole episode is that after all that wait and aggravation, I never got a chance to talk with the doctor who examined Becky. How's she doing today?
I don't know yet, Kim said. It was too early for me to call when I got up, and Tracy hasn't called me. But she's got to be doing better. Her blood work was fine, and she's been afebrile.
Dr. Regis, a voice called.
Kim turned to see Deborah Silverman, the O.R. head nurse, beckoning toward him. Kim detoured to the O.R. desk.
Dr. Biddle called while you were in surgery, Deborah said. He left a message for you to stop into his office as soon as you were out.
Kim took the message slip. It was punctuated with a number of exclamation points. Apparently, it was serious.
Uh-oh, Tom commented over Kim's shoulder.
Sounds to me like the chief is planning on adding to your aggravation.
Kim and Tom parted ways at the recovery room door. Kim went into the surgical locker room. Despite the implied urgency of Forrester Biddle's message, Kim took his time. It wasn't hard to guess what Forrester wanted to see him about. The problem was that after a point, Kim wasn't sure he understood his own behavior. Kim took a shower and mulled over in his mind the previous evening's experience. He didn't reach any epiphany beyond admitting he'd been unduly stressed. After dressing in a clean set of scrubs, Kim used the phone in the surgical lounge to call Ginger at the office to discuss the afternoon schedule. Only then did he make his way over to the chief's office in the administration wing. Dr. Forrester Biddle was the quintessential New England conservative. He had the gaunt look of a Puritan preacher and the acerbic personality to go with it. His only redeeming quality was that he was an excellent surgeon.
"Come in and close the door," Forrester said as Kim stepped into his cramped, journal-filled office. "Take a seat."
Kim sat down. Forrester made him wait while some paperwork was being completed. Kim's eyes roamed the room. Kim noted he'd had a much better office as chief over at the Samaritan. After adding his signature with a flourish, Forrester slapped down his pen on his desktop so that it sounded like a distant report of a firearm.
"I'll get right to the point," he said, assuming an expression more stern than usual. "Your behavior last night in the emergency room is an embarrassment to this department, as well as to the entire medical staff."
"My daughter was in pain," Kim said simply. It was an explanation, not an excuse. He was not inclined to sound remorseful.
"There's no excuse for violence," Forrester remarked. "Mr. Bradford is considering filing charges, and I wouldn't blame him if he did."
"If anybody gets sued, it should be AmeriCare," Kim said. "I waited over 3 hours, mostly so that AmeriCare can maximize profits."
"Assaulting an administrator is no way to make social commentary," Forrester said. "Nor, I might add, is appealing directly to the media. I wasn't going to say anything about your quote Kelly Anderson gave during the Friday night news until this inexcusable episode of battery. Saying publicly that the rationale for the merger of the University Medical Center and the Samaritan was to benefit AmeriCare's bottom line hurts the reputation of this hospital."
Kim stood up. The meeting was not going to be a discussion, and there was no way Kim would sit there and absorb reprimands like a delinquent schoolboy. "If that's all, I have patients to see." Forrester pushed his chair back and stood up as well.
"I think you should keep in mind, Dr. Regis," he said. "This department seriously considered hiring a full-time salaried surgeon to cover your area of valve replacement prior to the merger. Your behavior of late is making us reevaluate that issue."
Kim turned around and left without responding. He wasn't about to validate such a comment. It was hardly the threat that Forrester intended. In reality, Kim was being repeatedly recruited to take over a number of prestigious departments around the country. The only reason he was still at the University Medical Center was because of shared custody of Becky, and the fact that Tracy couldn't move because of her matriculation in the liberal arts college. But Kim was again angry. Of late, it seemed to be his constant state of mind. Striding out of the administrative area of the hospital, he practically ran head-on into Kelly Anderson and her cameraman, Brian.
"Ah," Kelly squealed with apparent delight. "Dr. Regis, just the man I've been hoping to see."
Kim flashed a nasty glance at the TV journalist and continued down the corridor at a brisk pace. Kelly reversed directions and ran after him. Brian kept pace despite his burden of equipment.
"My God, Dr. Regis," Kelly panted. "Are you in training for a marathon? Slow down, I need to talk with you."
"I've no intention of talking with you," Kim said.
But I want to hear your side of last night's ER episode, Kelly said.
Kim pulled up short, forcing Brian to collide with him. Brian apologized effusively. Kim ignored him and peered at Kelly in surprise.
How in God's name did you hear about that, and so quickly?
Surprised you, huh? Kelly remarked, with a sly, self-satisfied smile. But I'm sure you understand that I can't reveal my sources. You see, I do so many medical-related stories that I've developed a kind of fifth column here at the Med Center. You'd be surprised about the gossip I get. Unfortunately, it's usually as prosaic as who's screwing whom. But once in a while, I get a real tip, like your episode in the ER last night. Cardiac surgeon punches out administrator. That's news.
I don't have anything to say to you, Kim responded. He recommenced walking.
Kelly caught up to him.
Ah, but I think you do, she said. Having to wait 3 hours in an emergency room with a sick child must have been a major aggravation that I'd love to discuss.
Too bad, Kim said. Among other things, I was just reprimanded for giving you that bottom line quote. I'm not talking with you.
So the administration hates the truth, Kelly said. That in itself is interesting.
I'm not talking to you, Kim repeated. You might as well save your breath.
Oh, come on, Kelly said. Your having to wait hours to be seen in the emergency room will strike a familiar chord with my viewers, especially with the ironic twist that it's a doctor doing the waiting. We don't even have to discuss the assault and battery part if you don't want.
Yeah, sure, as if I could trust you, Kim said.
You can, Kelly said. You see, I think having to wait so long relates to the merger story. I believe it has something to do with Americare's interest in profits. What do you think?
Kim looked at Kelly as they walked. Her bright blue-green eyes sparkled. Kim had to admit that although she was a pain in the neck, she was also smart as a whip.
You said it, not me, Kim remarked. So no quotes. My life right now is sufficiently screwed up that I don't need you to make it worse. Goodbye, Miss Anderson.
Kim went through a pair of swinging doors leading back into the operating area. Kelly pulled to a stop to the relief of Brian. Both were out of breath.
Well, we tried, Kelly said. The sad irony is that this time I'm sincerely sympathetic. A month ago I had to wait almost the same amount of time with my own daughter.
Kim entered his office complex by the back door. It gave him a chance to get into his private office without having to go through the waiting room. As he struggled out of his suit jacket, he picked up his phone and got Ginger at the reception desk.
I'm back, Kim said. With the receiver caught in the crook of his neck, he walked over to his closet. The telephone wire was just long enough.
You've got a waiting room full of patients, Ginger said. Thanks to Tom's emergency surgery, you're about 2 hours behind schedule.
Any phone messages of import? Kim asked.
He managed to get his jacket hung up and grabbed his short white doctor's jacket.
Nothing that can't wait, Ginger said.
No calls from Tracy?
No, Ginger said.
Okay, have Cheryl start moving the patients into the examining rooms, Kim said. After slipping on the white jacket and collecting the pens and other paraphernalia he kept in his pockets, Kim dialed Tracy's number. While the call went through, he draped his stethoscope around his neck. Tracy answered on the first ring, as if she were right next to the phone.
Well, how's the patient doing? Kim asked. He tried to sound upbeat.